that instead of organizing decent housing, the French government has spread rumors that it will evict more people than former years, without necessarily providing an alternative accommodation.
Me and my children are housed at my friend's home. My husband is at his friend's home. That's our situation for 15 years. Since more than 15 years, we are demanding a social accommodation to the city hall. That's insane.
In a spectacular protest action this week, homeless migrants deployed 300 tents at the Place de la République. The homeless and poorly housed people demand to be housed in decent places. They say there are enough empty buildings to accommodate everybody. What a dramatic contradiction between these people living in tents and huge empty buildings like the Samaritaine here in the center of Paris.
Le COVID.
The COVID makes the housing crisis worse, but the real problem is the speculation on real estate that leads concretely to an outburst of the rents, to the eviction of people so that the apartments can be sold empty.
The police supervised thoroughly this march in Paris. Housing people in empty buildings is apparently touching a sensitive chord. Similar marches took place on Saturday in many French cities and also in 20 other European Union countries. This proves that the housing issue is a global problem that should be resolved not only by the French government, but also by the European Parliament and European Commission. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Just ahead of United States President Joe Biden's long-awaited first press conference, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell made the media rounds claiming that substantial economic progress has been made. However, that contradicted extensive new data from the Fed itself, which found that the economy contracted in February, while their National Activity Index plunged into the negative for the first time since last April, the peak of the pandemic. The index, based on 85 indicators regarding personal spending, employment, retail sales, and production, has been in the negative over the average of the last 3 months, disproving widespread bullish talk that the U.S. economy is recovering. What is certain is that there was no so-called snapback or V-shaped recovery. Instead, a K-shaped recovery has become cemented, with the wealth of the upper class increasing while the lower and middle classes continue to plunge. Biden recently approved a $1.9 trillion emergency coronavirus plan, but it didn't include a single long-term social program. He also backtracked on key issues such as a $15 minimum wage, student debt relief, and the size of household stimulus. This week, top pollster Ipsos found that Biden's approval rating plunged 6 points.
The Democrats do not want to have all the power to run the country. But when they do, it becomes obvious that they're not doing it on behalf of anybody but the ruling class. They're doing as little as they can to keep the pitchforks, to try and keep the pitchforks at home and not disturb the profit-making powers of the profitable industry of healthcare, for example.
George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump all refused to boost the economy of the everyman despite prolonged economic malaise. Failure to remedy the terrible economic data from 2020 and over the first quarter of 2021 could cause major dissension in an incredibly polarized nation.
Fascism comes in on the failure of social democracy. They get angry. There's not even social democracy to fail. They may try social democracy, but they're at that point yet. They're in control of things. This is one of the reasons I don't think fascism is an imminent threat, because what do they have to gain by it that they don't already have?
The U.S. is betting that a major coronavirus vaccine rollout will return economic growth to pre-pandemic levels no later than the second half of this year, hopefully. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hours after the Yemeni army launched one of its largest retaliatory attacks on the Saudi-led coalition, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Sana'a to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The gathering today is the gathering of those who trust in God. These people have proven that they were able to take advantage of the war to develop their military capabilities. Today, our victory is crowned by our ability to stop Aramco by using our strategic deterrent weapons.
Yemenis say the seventh year of Saudi rule will be different as the Yemeni army is escalating its retaliatory attacks against Saudi facilities, pushing the kingdom to stop its years-long rule and to move toward a political solution to protect its oil giant Aramco from Yemeni attacks.
Yemeni people have withstood the aggression surprisingly. The Saudi enemy declared this criminal war from the White House in Washington to bring the Yemeni people to their knees, but they failed because Yemenis trust in God. 6 years ago, Yemenis woke up to the bombing of Saudi airstrikes and the bloodshed of children and women. And today the Saudis and Emiratis woke up to the burning of their oil companies by our missiles and drones. This proves that Yemeni people are getting stronger year after year.
Earlier, the Yemeni army inaugurated the seventh year with the National Day of Resilience operation against several military and economic targets in Saudi Arabia. The operation is the largest so far and used 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles.
Thousands of Yemenis have gathered to mark the 7th anniversary of Saudi rule and siege of their country. They say their army now is capable of forcing the kingdom to stop its deadly war without conditions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective.
Yes.
Given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologising to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside the school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're the basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
After firing two cruise missiles Sunday, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles early Thursday morning. U.S. President Joe Biden responded.
There will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly. But I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
The latest launches are widely considered to be in violation of UN Security Council sanctions against Pyongyang, which are strongly supported by the United States and limit North Korea's ability to develop its economy. North Korea's recent missile tests demonstrate that maintaining the status quo in terms of ongoing United Nations Security Council sanctions is unacceptable to Pyongyang. And experts agree that the timing of the tests was clearly designed to influence the Biden administration's ongoing North Korea policy review. Experts argue that the U.S. needs to live up to the Singapore summit agreement between former U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which was violated with recent joint U.S.-South Korea military drills.
From North Korea's perspective, the South Korea-U.S. military exercises, pressure on human rights, and sanctions are threatening. Pyongyang needs to be guaranteed the right to live. If the U.S. has a sincere attitude before approaching North Korea, they will get a response.
U.S. officials recently toured the region to consult allies, with expectations the Biden administration's new policy toward North Korea will be announced within weeks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honor their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy, and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium. This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is people are dying due to the pace of the EU's vaccination rollout program. There's economic disaster looming for millions of businesses in the EU as new lockdowns are announced. In some nations, jobs are being lost at a record rate. The tourism industry is on its knees. Citizens are frustrated.
Our government was telling that it would be better in May and the opening of the cafes, restaurants and so on. And nowadays I don't dare make a plan.
For the moment, the situation is so difficult that everybody's complaining about everything. And I understand that. It's not easy.
Critics say the health, social and economic consequences of the EU's failures during this crisis are not yet fully clear. Analysts warn there are likely to be dire political consequences for the establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A massive air show in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The armed forces flex their muscles on the eve of Pakistan's National Day. Pakistan celebrates every year the very idea of its creation in the name of Islam over 80 years ago, when this part of the world, together with India, was under the imperial rule of the British. The significant part of the air show was the acrobatic maneuverability of our planes known as JF Thunder. Pakistan indigenously manufactured them in cooperation with China after the US stopped the supplies of F-16 fighter jets. Pakistan is fast reducing its reliance on the US for military hardwares, with the growing role of China in the indigenous production of its high-tech weapons with focus on fighter jets.
Pakistan is today manufacturing the JS-17, which has excellent capabilities and in a way is replacing the F-16. And if even the spares are denied to Pakistan, it seeks those from other countries or tries to manufacture it within Pakistan. The U.S. has many restrictions and sanctions. It's relying more and more on China and other European countries.
Pakistan had four wars with India, three of which over disputed Kashmir region, divided between two nuclear-armed neighbors in South Asia.
And a strong
atomy quwwat hai.
Pakistan is a strong nuclear armed state. Beyond an iota of doubt, the peace in the region is linked with the fair solution of Kashmir dispute. We want to move forward with a desire of peace, but let me make it clear that our desire for peace must not be mistaken our weakness. Any misadventure against Pakistan would be responded back with a full force.
According to a study by American think tanks like Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Simpson Center, Islamabad is far outpacing New Delhi in the development of nuclear warheads, and Pakistan would possess more nuclear weapons than any other country except Russia and U.S. within the next 4 to 5 years. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
After more than 2 months of almost unprecedented delay, United States President Joe Biden faced journalists in his very first press conference. Biden often read from prepared notes and spoke for just an hour. He selected the reporters who could ask him questions and avoided the conservative media, which has regularly asked that he finally engage with journalists without scripted questions or aides to help him.
Biden doesn't have any. Why? I think you're... the speculation is very valid that he is in cognitive decline. They're worried that he can't, he wouldn't be able to hold up over press questioning for a while. They're worried that he won't be able to hold up if he had to give a good big speech.
Biden fielded questions on changes to voting laws and the Senate filibuster tactic, avoided questions on gun control, and said he expects to run for re-election. Even though the country is in the middle of the worst socioeconomic crisis since the Great Depression, the mainstream media journalists allowed to attend awarded the largest portion of their questions to a problem outside the country's borders, the increase of refugees from Latin America. There appeared to be very little of the often extreme combativeness and skepticism towards Biden as there was towards his predecessor, Donald Trump. During the presidential campaign, both mainstream media and social media corporations were routinely accused of giving Biden preferential treatment. Corruption allegations involving his son went ignored, while many said Biden rarely faced difficult questions.
There's the right-wing press that, of course, are going to attack him. And then there's the press that support him, and they're not going to say anything critical of him. They're not going to say anything critical of certain Democrats either.
On foreign policy, neither Iran nor Russia was mentioned. Regarding Afghanistan, Biden said it would be hard to meet the May 1st deadline set for America's total withdrawal, but he also said that he did not picture troops still occupying Afghanistan in 2022. Keeping up his antagonistic stance towards China, Biden alleged that Chinese President Xi Jinping, quote, doesn't have a democratic bone in his body. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
the limelight.
According to the FBI's preliminary uniform crime report for the first half of 2020, murder and non-negligent manslaughter offenses increased 14.8%, and aggravated assault offenses were up 4.6% across the U.S. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ryan McMakin, editor. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Homicides Are Way Up in 2020. Here's more. According to the FBI's preliminary uniform crime report for the first half of 2020, murder and non-negligent manslaughter offenses increased 14.8%, and aggravated assault offenses were up 4.6% in the U.S. If the second half of 2020 proves to be about the same as the first half, then the nationwide homicide rate for 2020 will have risen from 5 per 100,000 in 2019 to 5.8 per 100,000 in 2020. That's a big increase and puts 2020's total at the highest rate recorded in 15 years, matching 2006 rate of 5.8 per 100,000. Some other data, however, suggests the year-end numbers for 2020 will be even worse than that. Homicides look to be up more than 20% during the fall of 2020 compared to the previous year. Thus, the increase from 2019 to 2020 may prove to be one of the largest increases in homicide in more than 50 years. Meanwhile, homicides in certain U.S. cities increased by far worse rates. Year-over-year increases of 30% or more were common in 2020, and this wasn't limited to only large cities. In data posted by researcher Jeff Asher, total year-over-year homicides through September 2020 were up in a wide range of locations. Up 55% in Chicago, up 54% in Boston, up 38% in Denver, and up 105% in Omaha. It's much easier to count homicides than to determine the events and phenomena driving trends in homicides. It's never a good idea to attribute changes in homicide totals to any single cause. If you're looking to ask ourselves what might have caused such an unusually large rise in homicide across the U.S., we ought to look for unusual events. Most obvious among these, of course, are the stay-at-home orders, business closures, and lockdowns that have occurred since March of last year. These are pretty unusual things, although it is considered somewhat heretical to point out that lockdowns can produce negative societal side effects. The connection to violent behavior is so undeniable that this is now openly admitted. During the government-mandated lockdown, some organizations specifically devoted to violence prevention were shut down. And as noted by law professor Tracy Mears, the pandemic has prevented many anti-violence programs from operating. These programs, however, require a great deal of a face-to-face contact, typically among service providers and folks who are most likely to both commit these offenses and be the victims of them, Mears says. And it's a lot harder to do that when people can't meet in person. Of course, it's not that these people just can't meet in person as if it were physically impossible to do so. It's that in many places they are legally prohibited from doing so. This means even the most urgent cases were neglected and put on the back burner because policymakers made a decision to ignore the realities of violent crime in order to obsess over COVID risk. And this is a point must be made repeatedly. The pandemic isn't what caused the widespread destruction of social institutions that are key in increasing social cohesion and preventing violence. Government edicts did this. Certainly, given fears over COVID infection, it stands to reason that at least some people would have elected to stay home, and that important social institutions would have functioned at reduced capacity even without government mandates. However, what government mandates did was prevent people from even using their own discretion, which means even the most at-risk, isolated, and emotionally volatile people, the people who need these institutions the most, were cut off from important resources. Also important in understanding homicides is the fact that COVID lockdowns have increased domestic violence. Again, advocates for stay-at-home orders have used their bizarrely extreme preoccupation with COVID deaths as an excuse to insist it is worth it to keep women and children locked up with their abusers. Homicides have increased as a result in many cases. The lockdowns aren't the only factors behind rising crime, of course. Another factor is the rising homicide rate is likely the decline of public trust in police institutions. The reputations of police and police organizations appear to have gone into significant decline in recent years, as police encounters are increasingly being recorded and made public, thus exposing police abuse and what at least appears to be police abuse. These events have been connected to rising rates of violent crime. As noted by crime historian Ronaldo Froth, the public trust in government institutions, which certainly includes police, can impact a community's willingness to turn to violence in personal interactions. In other words, anti-police sentiment is regarded as a likely indirect cause of growing homicide rates. This declining trust manifested itself in last summer's riots, but the origins of the riots predate both the riots and the George Floyd case. But even when we look to the role of police agencies' status within the communities, we find that stay-at-home orders and lockdowns again play a role. It is the police, after all, who have been responsible for enforcing government orders to wear masks, close businesses, and avoid gatherings. Throughout 2020, U.S. police have been essential in harassing churchgoers, beating up nonviolent citizens for not social distancing, and arresting women for not wearing masks. Police have also arrested business owners and shut down their businesses. And then there was the case of a 6-year-old girl who was taken from her mother because the mother wasn't wearing a mask when she dropped her daughter off at school. Who will be providing the regime's muscle when it comes to separating this child from her mother? Naturally, it will be the police. Although the police have continued to enjoy uncritical support from the Back the Blue movement, more reasonable people can only tolerate so much when it comes to police who willingly attack and arrest people from the non-crimes of using their own private property or not wearing a mask on a public sidewalk. It's unclear at this point if reversing policies that caused a year of community destruction can quickly undo the damage. The police must be out of the business of roughing people up in the name of social distancing. The politicians' obsession with isolating people must end.
the debate.
Hello and welcome. My name is Gisumish Ahmadi. Now, Kill the Bill protests continue all across the UK. While many of these demonstrations have ended in violence, there is still no sign of Parliament backing down on a controversial legislation known as the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill that could give law enforcement officers more powers to crack down on protests. In this edition of the debate, we will be discussing why UK protesters oppose the police bill and how it has cleared its second reading in the House of Commons. But first, let's go to London and talk to Saeed Pourreza.
Gisu, yes, this protest happened across the country. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of London and Manchester, with cities such as Bradford, Bath, and Nottingham, among others, playing host to those protests. 18 arrests were made in Manchester city center, where the protesters have blocked the tram service. And it's become a thing, really. These protests all begin peacefully up until the riot police arrive with their riot gear and their horses and dogs, and the protests descend into violence. And police, we have seen from the footage, have really been heavy-handed in their treatment of those demonstrators. Today's protests really follow another one that happened in Bristol, a place that's seen other protests as well over the past couple of weeks. 10 arrests were made there after the demonstration descended into violence as well after the police arrived. The police in Bristol have really come under fire for the treatment of the demonstrators and for an attack on a journalist, journalist named Matthew Dretch, who works for the Daily Mirror, has posted a video of himself coming under attack by the police, who were there with their batons and shields, even as he told them that he was a member of the media. As you say, the controversial policing bill is being debated on in Parliament. It'll have to clear another vote and survive another vote in the House of Commons of the British Parliament. Then it'll move on to the House of Lords, and finally it'll have to get or gain royal assent before it is written into law. The government has supported the actions of the police. The Prime Minister has come out, Boris Johnson, calling what happened in Bristol as disgraceful. But the fact of the matter is that these protesters are out there to stay, and they're saying that they're going to continue doing what they have been doing, which is opposing this bill, forcing a rethinking of it all by the government. But we know that the fact that the government has a majority in Parliament will really give it a strong hand in getting this bill through the legislature and turning it into law. But the critics, among them politicians on the left, are saying that really what this bill does is curtail freedoms, freedom of expression, of speech, like how noisy a protest can be, and things that go with it. And they're also saying that the day that this bill is written into law will be a day that the UK, as a democracy, will turn into a dictatorship, Kisu.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Saeed Pourreza, joining us from London. And also, we have investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who's joining us from Bristol. Now, Mr. Gosling, why was the police bill proposed in the first place? By the footage that we see, it seems that the police already have enough powers.
Well, funnily enough, parts of the bill the police themselves said they didn't want. And it's a very good report by your journalist there. But one thing he missed out is there's a very, very important part of this, what is being called now here the Police State Bill, which is to do with trespass and criminalising trespass. That's one of the protests which the police were particularly violent at, even though the demonstrators in Bristol were sitting down with their hands in the air, with their hands up, you know, The police still went in with the dogs, arrested 14 or so of them. Many of, you know, that's something like, you know, one in 20 of the people who were there. So this is another aspect. And the timing is interesting, isn't it? Because this is all being pushed through under a lockdown. And so the mayor of Bristol, the mayor of London, the police chiefs, etc., and Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who I think is really the one main person behind the police violence, is saying, oh, well, you can't protest because of a lockdown. Well, you know, the 20,000 or so people in Bristol who are about to be criminalised by this bill, of course they are going to protest. They're not going to say, well, we'll wait until the lockdown's finished and then we will, because this is the crucial stage. We're going through into the committee stage of the bill in Parliament, and at that point, this is the point where you need to make your voice heard, and you need to say to the police and to the media and to the general public and to the politicians, we're not going to stand for this bill. You know, there's a whole bunch of people been involved in this Kill the Bill protest movement, which is sprung up literally over the last month or so. But the thing is, this word Kill the Bill, let me explain for your viewers, the bill is the old bill in Cockney rhyming slang. It is what we use to refer to the police. So Kill the Bill has a connotation of killing the police. So that's why it's a bit of a cheeky word to use, but actually, of course, it's the bill they're referring to, this police state bill that they want to kill. Now, this was something that I was involved, actually, as a journalist and as a marcher back in 1994 in the Criminal Justice Act in Britain, which was the first step towards what they're trying to do to completely criminalise trespass in Britain, where they got rid of free parties. They brought in something called aggravated trespass, where the police would get more involved. Usually it's just up to the landowner to do something about it if someone turns up on their land. So there is an echo right back to the 1990s, and really what this bill is trying to do is to pick up on those the criminalisation of trespass that happened back then and make it actually a permanent thing. In fact, it's very similar to the law in the United States, and quite a lot of what we do in Britain is they have criminal trespass laws in the US which are very similar. But we in Britain have had travelling people, itinerant people, squatters, etc., for thousands of years, since time immemorial. And this is the first time there's ever been an attempt in Britain to turn all those people into criminals. And that's why I think there's been such a move against the police, particularly demonstrations, peaceful and some not so peaceful, to show the strength of feeling, to send a very clear message that they're not going to use a lockdown to stop a demonstration against this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. Let's also turn to journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who is with us from Plymouth. Mr. Tweedy, why is the British government pushing for this bill, despite the backlash, all these protests that we see all across the UK?
Well, I mean, there's more than one backlash, perhaps. I mean, if you're going to protest, you have to be careful that you don't alienate the majority and by causing so much mess and inconvenience and damage to the cities where you're protesting, and that's what happened in Bristol to a large extent. They were smashing up people's private cars. My fellow guest here has mentioned the meaning of Kill the Bill. You know, I mean, it is essentially an advert to anarchists to come and have a fight with the police, which, you know, sometimes the police are quite happy to do, probably. But these protests are—they've kind of jumped the shark, and they're likely to alienate people. So it's a problem. The bill is, you know, it like a lot of crime bills in Parliament. It contains a lot of very disparate elements, and some of those are new laws to prevent violent criminals and sex offenders and people convicted of terrorist offences too from being released halfway through their sentence on licence, on parole, right? They're going to have to wait until two-thirds through their sentence, if this bill passes, to be released. And that's something that's actually very difficult for anyone on the government benches or in the opposition to argue against. In fact, the opposition have said that they agree with that, basically. And they abstained on the first vote against this bill. But Yeah, the second is, you know, on the second one they voted against it, but because of what happened on Clapham Common a few days earlier, and that when the vigil for a woman who was murdered, Sarah Everard, was broken up by the Metropolitan Police, the London Police, but that what happened there was done under rules, which special lockdown rules, which essentially make all large.
Well, actually, it's interesting that
illegal.
You pointed to that particular incident. Well, all of this comes at a time that it's in the wake of actually the murder of Sarah Everard, who was incidentally murdered by a police officer on her way back home. And that would sound the alarm, one would think, for the parliamentarians, you know, to be more cautious about the type of bill that they would bring into law. Or that doesn't seem to be the case, though, Mr. Tweedy, does it?
The bill was drafted long before that happened. It was drafted, you know, it was this, you know, this debate's been going on for a year or two now, you know. What happened there was that the Metropolitan Police went over the top, and the Metropolitan Police is the commissioner, the chief inspector of that police force is Cressida Dick, and Cressida Dick was in charge of the operation that back in 2007, which saw an innocent man killed. A Brazilian immigrant was apparently mistaken for, British Bangladeshi, John Charles de Menezes, and he was killed, and then the police leaked stuff to the media and told lies about it. So this person, who was, by the way, promoted by members of the Labour Party, she was in charge, you see, and, okay, so there are these rules against, that have been introduced during the lockdown, against large public gatherings, and the police have been applying them selectively, and it's okay for the police to have that discretion, but on that occasion, it was very obvious, you know, they'd allowed a lot of very large and angry protests and marches and things to go ahead, and then this thing was a silent, static vigil in a park at night when there weren't a lot of people around, and they broke it up quite forcefully for some reason. I don't understand why they did that at all.
Well,
exactly. Mr. Gosling, I think you could comment on that, please.
That's right. We now know why. It's because The Guardian got a leaked memo from the Home Office explaining that it was directly Priti Patel herself that had written a memo to the Metropolitan Police asking for them, or in fact, she's not really asking, is she? She's telling them to shut this vigil down for Sarah Everard. I mean, she's a provocateur. But let's not forget that Priti Patel, back in 2017, was sacked for 12 illegal meetings with the Israeli government when she was the DFID secretary, that's the foreign aid secretary, and she was sacked for those, including one of the things she was trying to do secretly when she was said she was on a private holiday, she was secretly meeting with all these Israeli officials. One of the things she tried to do was to get British public money for the Israeli army in the Golan Heights. Now, she is a traitor for having those meetings, and she should never have been allowed back into government. And now she's actually managing to steal a march on Boris, really, by making him look stupid, and he hasn't got the guts to sack her. He should sack her right now for ordering the police into that vigil on Clapham Common. It's one of the most disgusting bits of policing we've ever seen in Britain, and it's no part of a democracy. This is police state policing being done specifically by Priti Patel, and we've got the memo, we've got the evidence that it was her behind it.
And honestly, Mr. Gosling, it's very paradoxical for us outside the UK to see police violence in response to peaceful protesters that are concerned about exactly that. So what kind of message do you think this is sending the world?
Well, what we're seeing here is, I think, a real hiatus in British politics at the moment. It all depends on whether Boris has got the guts to sack the traitors within his own cabinet, but I don't think he has. I think he's a very weak prime minister, and what we'll see, I think, in the next few months is we're going to see more and more confrontations over this particular act of parliament. Just think how reckless and stupid it is of Priti Patel to be pushing a bill through which is going to make at least 20,000 people in Bristol, that is the people who have got their housing problems, that were sort of homeless, people that cannot afford to either pay a mortgage or pay the rent. We've got something like 20,000 of them in Bristol, officially homeless. She's going to try and turn them all into criminals. The idea here, of course, is to turn the forces of government on the poor. And what's also been going on at the same time is complete impunity for criminals who are rich. Particularly, we're talking here about bankers. And in Bristol, we've got the Lloyds Bank, the business support unit, which has been accused by former police officers and by campaigners and people who've lost their property of fraud, very much like the Reading fraud that was also being done by Lloyds Bank several years ago, and people were prosecuted and jailed for. They're not being jailed in Bristol. So what we're seeing here is the machinery of criminal justice being turned from the criminals onto the most vulnerable in society. And I think that really is a recipe, if it's not stopped, for civil war in Britain.
And it is actually very interesting. Mr. Tweedy, the rules set out in the bill can be applied to a demonstration of just one person. What exactly does that mean?
Well, okay, I mean, maybe it can be any kind of demonstration can be shut down, but actually we've had rules more or less to that effect for a long time now. It's been very difficult to organise protests in London. You have to get, outside Parliament, for instance, or outside 10 Downing Street, you have to get permission. I mean, in practice, they've gone ahead, for sure, it's been done, but you have to... These are rules that were introduced about 20 years ago, which there are already restrictions on the right to protest. It's not unfettered. We can turn to other things. I mean, there's been a certain amount of controversy about the part of the bill which increases the penalties for vandalising public property, in particular monuments. Not other forms of public property, but monuments. There's a thing. I mean, why is that been written into this bill? It's because some middle class white people who were attending a Black Lives Matter protest decided that it would be funny to graffiti a statue of Winston Churchill. And then there was other graffiti put on a statue of Gandhi and on the cenotaph on a war memorial. You see, so we have this thing where we have Britain is full of memorials to war memorials, and of course most of them commemorate at some point, or many of them commemorate the Second World War, which is the war against fascism, in which we were led by Winston Churchill, because that's the history of it. And there are other memorials to the volunteers who went to Spain to fight in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side against the Falangists and the Carlists, the fascists, basically. And, these memorials are now, vandalizing these memorials could get you 10 years in jail now.
Exactly, 10 years in jail. Quite a penalty. Mr. Gosling, don't you think so?
Well, look, the main reason they're doing this is because of what happened last year at the Black Lives Matter protest in Bristol, where the statue of Edward Colston was pulled down and thrown into the docks. And there have been many of us, historians like myself, who have been calling for this statue to be put somewhere less prominent, maybe in a museum or something like that, for many years, and they've been ignored. Edward Colston was a slave trader, but his name is all over Bristol. Colston Hall, there's various other places, Colston Hill. So he is almost, there's Colston Tower. There's various places around Bristol commemorating this slave trader. And he is supposed to be some sort of great guy. Of course he wasn't. He was making money from misery and racism, as many, of course, were in those times. And so I think
pretty
it's absolutely right
that
there was some kind of challenge
Mr. Gosling.
To this being a prominent person. And that's why they've done this, I think. That's the only reason. Look, I think this is, in a way, a bit of a side issue, because this bill, what it will do is it will give the police discretion as to which demonstrations they close down. Of course, that demonstration I'm talking about last year wasn't closed down. There were just a handful of police around. If we get to the situation where the police can pick and choose who they like and who they don't like, if there's a particular, say, for example, an anti-police demonstration, they come in with the riot police. If it's Extinction Rebellion, they start dancing with the demonstrators, then this is a police state. And that's what most people are objecting to when they say kill the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling. There's one final question. We really don't have that much time. So, Mr. Tweedy, if you could please make it quick. Why do you think there is so much rush on voting on this bill? Why not give parliamentarians more time to scrutinize it?
I don't think it is being rushed. I mean, it's only just passed the second reading, and now it's in the House of Lords, and that will take a long time. They'll make amendments to it, and that will go back to Parliament. And if the government doesn't want to accept those amendments, there's going to be quite a long period of, tenets where they...
So you do believe that there will be enough time to scrutinise the bill?
Yeah, there's plenty of time to scrutinise it. It's been published and people can read it. The question is, why did the Labour Party abstain on it in the first place and then vote against it the second time? It's just because of what happened on Clapham Common. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The Labour Party is playing a political game. Firstly, their political game was not.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Gosling, just one final question, make it quick. Are you as optimistic as Mr. Tweedy? Do you think there will be enough time to make changes to this bill?
Well, there'll be many more demonstrations, and that's what we're going to be seeing, because we've got something like 1 million people, most of the arrests at these demonstrations have been basically young people between the ages of about 16, 18 and 22, 25. I've seen the figures of the ages of people arrested in Bristol. We're talking here about the young people are scared about their future. They think that there is no future for them. There's no jobs. There's not the education they're getting is very poor. And so they're saying, if we cannot actually demonstrate against changes that we believe which are going to affect our future, then we are going to make some changes right now. And I think that the youngsters have decided that this bill is simply not going to go through, and they'll stop at almost nothing to make sure they send a very strong signal to our politicians that they are going to be there on the barricades, and we could even have a civil war, as I said. If you're going to make up to 1 million people who can't afford rent and mortgage, criminals, then, of course, you're going to have a serious problem on your hands, and I don't think the government really wants that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol, and journalist and commentator James Tweedy out of Plymouth. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Debate, and also thanks for following us.